Audible Originals presents Evil Has a Name, the untold story of the Golden State Killer investigation, written by Paul Holes, Jim Clemente, Peter McDonnell, and Mitch Hansen. Featuring the voices of Detective Paul Holes, the original investigators on the case, victims and their family members, the genealogist who helped bring about an arrest, as well as those who worked with, fished with, and were neighbors of the man suspected of being the Golden State Killer. I'm Jim Clemente, retired FBI agent and profiler, and this is the Audible original, Evil Has a Name. It's the unbelievable true story of the hunt for the Golden State Killer, as told by dozens of those closest to the investigation. We'd like to warn you that there are descriptions of violence and sexual assault throughout this story. It may not be appropriate for some listeners. Chapter 1, The Young Criminalist.
The East Area Rapist supposedly struck this quiet, upper-middle-class neighborhood in the Rancho San Miguel area of Walnut Creek near John Muir Hospital about 4 this morning. The victim, a 13-year-old girl, was threatened with a knife, tied up, and raped as her sister and father slept in nearby bedrooms. This is the second time the rapist has struck in this neighborhood within the last month.
I would hear that deep, muffled voice.
Everything he said was this harsh whisper.
Do you want to die? Do you want me to kill your mother?
Shut up. You know, shut up or I'll kill you.
From 1976 to 1986, the Golden State Killer raped at least 50 women and killed 13 people. Questions about who committed these rapes and murders went unanswered for far too long. Now, 42 years later, it seems we finally have an answer.
Yesterday afternoon, my detectives arrested James Joseph DeAngelo, 72 years old, living in Citrus Heights.
We found the needle in the haystack, and it was right here in Sacramento.
Finally, evil has a name.
The outstanding work to bring resolution to this case was in part led by Paul Holes.
An investigator on the case, Paul Holes.
From Contra Costa County, Paul Holes.
Has investigated this case for over 24 years.
Our story begins exactly 1 month prior to the arrest. It's Paul Holes' last day of work before he retires. Paul is a detective in Contra Costa County, a suburb near Sacramento, California, which is where most of the Golden State Killer attacks occurred. His groundbreaking approach with DNA has led him to a new primary suspect, 72-year-old Joseph James DeAngelo.
March 26 is going to be officially my last day working. And at this point, I decided I need to go see where this Joe DeAngelo is living. I drive up from my office to Citrus Heights, drive into the neighborhood. That's a decent-looking, middle-class neighborhood. The neighbors appear to take care of both their houses and their yards. The cars are in decent shape. And I come around the corner, and I park right across the street from DeAngelo's house. And I'm looking at the house. There was a car parked in the driveway, and his yard was immaculate, obsessively so. I back my car up a little bit to be able to get a better view of his backyard. I still don't see any activity outside, but I'm confident that he's home. I'm thinking, you know, I've been through this so many times. What's the likelihood that this DeAngelo is going to turn out to be the guy that I've been looking for? Now, I should just go up and knock on that front door, introduce myself, and just start talking to him. And eventually build up enough of a rapport in order to be able to get a DNA sample, just so I could close him out. I knew I wasn't going to solve this case now before I retired. I had less than a few hours left on the job. But at least I could make a significant contribution to this avenue of the investigation. But as I sat there contemplating going and talking to him, I realized I don't know enough about him. There's just enough here that he could be the guy, and I don't want to blow this. So at that point, I decided, I can't do that. I can't go knock on the door without knowing more information. And I put my car in drive, and I drove off. And I drove home, and there was that sinking feeling that that was the last decision I made on this case. The next day, I turned my badge and gun in and was driven home. I had a box, you know, with the typical walk out of the office and you got your family photographs and the knickknacks from your desk, you know, and I have to have somebody else drive me home because I've been driving a take-home car, a county car, forever, and now I no longer had access to that. It really struck that I'm no longer part of this. But the fortunate thing for me was, even though now I was retired, though I wasn't driving into the office, I was still working this case as if I were active duty. In hindsight, when I think about the decision to not walk up to his front door, probably the best decision I made in my life.
Golden State Killer is the moniker that connects three serial crime sprees to a single offender. In 1974, he begins breaking into houses in the rural central California city of Visalia. He rummages through drawers, steals personal items of little value, and masturbates on women's underwear. For this crime spree, he's called the Visalia Ransacker. In 1976, his crimes move north to the east area of Sacramento County. He breaks into homes at night, ties up his victims, then rapes the women. He does this over 50 times. This crime spree earns him the moniker the East Area Rapist. Then, in late 1979, his crimes migrate to Southern California, where he breaks into homes, ties up his victims, rapes the women, and then he murders them. In this crime spree, the man who started as a burglar has now become a serial killer known as the original Night Stalker. In total, he's believed to have committed over 100 break-ins, at least 50 rapes, and 13 murders. In 1986, he suddenly stops. It's not until 2001 that these three crime sprees are attributed to the man who would become known as the Golden State Killer. When investigating an unknown serial offender, we start with victimology, the study of the victim. And back in 1977, while this offender was stalking and preying on victims, a 13-year-old girl, Margaret Wardlow, was studying him.
Well, I was reading everything that was coming out in the newspaper about him prior to my attack. So from attack number 5, most likely, I believe, I don't know exactly when the sheriff came out and said we have a serial rapist on our hands, but it was a well-known fact by the time my attack happened. So anything and everything that was in the newspaper, I read. I remember one article I read 3 times over thinking, why don't they write more about him? And I know a lot of parents that probably wouldn't let their kids read this sort of thing because it's scary. It's really frightening. But my mom didn't hold anything back, and my mom was never one to shelter me from anything. My parents had gotten a divorce. I moved in with my mother. We moved into this condominium and lived there and had a window in my room, which is interesting looking back on it. If someone was on the levee and looking down into this first story of this home, and you didn't have the blinds drawn or you didn't have curtains, they could see everything that was going on in that house. I liken that house to like a dollhouse. Somebody walking on that levee in the evening can look into that house so perfectly and see exactly who lives there, what their patterns are, what they do during the evening, and whether there's anyone home during the day. So it was, I'm sure, a place that he was probably be looking at us and watching us and seeing who lived in that house. I had read every single article that had come out on this guy, and I wasn't concerned. My mom had always said, you know, I'm too old, her being 55, and you're too young, being 13. We aren't even possible victims of this guy. We had kind of a false sense of security. We had a single neighbor, a gentleman that was a single man, who invited us over to his home to listen to a new album that he had bought at Tower Records. We had dinner at his house. In leaving our home, we did not lock the front door, and we left the dog in the house. We came home probably about 8:30, 9 o'clock. I went to bed because it was a school night. I was awoken by this guy with these gloves on telling me, lay on your stomach, I want to tie you up, I'm going to tie you up. And I thought it was the neighbor we had just had dinner with. I thought my mom had invited him into the house to play a joke on me to get me up for school. And I said, no, quit joking, Bill, quit joking. And he kept insisting, this isn't a joke. This isn't a joke. I put my hands behind my back thinking this is going a bit far. And then he promptly left the room. And I thought, that's really weird. And I looked over at the clock radio. It was about 2:30 in the morning, and I just realized at that very moment, this is not my neighbor. This is not my neighbor. This is the East Area Rapist. And he gagged me, and then I was blindfolded as well. I could see out the bottom of the blindfold, and he was walking back and forth, you know? So you never knew when he was really gone. I just knew this guy wanted to scare me, or he wanted to see me scared. Every time he asked me, do you want me to kill your mom or do you want to die? I would just say, I don't care. It was the best response I had to just show him, I'm not afraid of you. And if I wasn't going to show fear, he wasn't going to get off on that. He was going into houses where there was a husband and a wife. He'd put the plates on the husband's back, and he would threaten the husband and say, if I hear these plates rattle, I'm going to kill your wife, and I'm going to come back in here, and I'm going to kill you. I heard him coming downstairs with those plates, and I just knew if he came into my room, he was going to rape my mom. If he went into my mother's room, he was going to rape me, and I could hear him walk into my mom's room. So I just mentally prepared myself. I knew I was going to be raped. I had a very calming voice from within that just told me, you're going to get raped. This is what's going to happen, and you're going to survive this. I get out of a lot of stuff, but this one you're just not going to be able to get out of. So he finished putting the plates on my mom's back, and he came into my room. He untied my feet, and he told me to put my legs up, and I just refused. I refused twice. I said no. And so he tried to have intercourse with me, but he wasn't able to, so he sodomized me for a very short period of time. I think in a lot of ways he lost his mojo. He didn't have a frightened victim in his midst. He had a very defiant teenager that wasn't willing to give in to his, frightening threats. I just wasn't willing to do what he wanted me to do. He had a large butcher knife that he'd gotten from our upstairs kitchen. And so he was using this big butcher knife on me, and he put it up to my ear. And I remember he was so mad after I got my feet untied. He said, do you want me to cut off your ear? Do you want me to cut off your ear? And I remember that was the time that I said no, because he really pressed it hard against the top of my ear. I could see his flashlight from underneath my blindfold, so I could see him coming and going. The dog was in my room the entire time of this attack. I looked over the dog and I said, Ollie, why aren't you doing anything? And the dog came up to me and licked my face and then laid back down again. And the East Area Rapist came into the room and said, who are you talking to? And I said, I'm talking to my dog. It was November, and so it was cold in the house, and I was shaking, I was shivering, I had no clothes on, and he asked me, what's wrong? And I said, I'm cold, and he took a blanket and covered me. I thought that was really strange. I was lying there very quietly, and I heard my mom start to scream, and she was yelling, help, help, and my initial thought was, oh my gosh, he's in there attacking her. And then I realized she's yelling for help for the neighbor to come. I got up, knowing that she was okay, and then I hopped up two flights of stairs and locked myself into that bathroom. The neighbor came, and he had a shotgun in his hands. He instructed his wife to come upstairs and get me out of the upstairs bathroom, and then she untied me. Back in those days, you didn't have 911. You had to actually dial a number to get the police to come and tell them what had happened. I sat on the sofa looking at my mom, and she just couldn't believe it. She just thought it was a copycat of the East Area Rapist. She didn't believe that that's really who it was. They were asking me, well, you know a lot about the East Area Rapist? And I said, yeah, I read every single article that comes out. I'm sure that's probably who it was. And when they heard that I told him, I don't care, when he threatened to kill my mother, they said to me, you said what? The sheriff's department took the dog away for a couple days to be tested to see if he had been poisoned, because the dog didn't really act. They took me into a separate bedroom, and then they sent in Carol Daly, who I will never, ever forget. She was just such a wonderful, wonderful, lovely person. Of course, I had to be taken off to the hospital. A rape kit was done. Carol accompanied myself and my mother to the hospital. She was there for us.
It's hard to overstate how important Carol Daly became to the Sacramento County victims of the East Area Rapist. In the late 1970s, there were very few female detectives in the county. Carol Daly was one of them.
I remember very, very distinctly coming home from school about, 2.5 weeks after the attack. It was my 14th birthday. And I got off the bus. I was walking up to my house, and there's a cop car in front of my house. I'm thinking, what's that doing there? What's going on? And so I walked up to the car, and it was just Carol Daly, and she was bringing me a card and a gift for my birthday. She said, you know, I just want to see your life return to normal as quickly as possible. And it was just a really wonderful, wonderful thing that she did for me that day.
All rapists lack moral boundaries, but raping a pubescent 13-year-old girl shows even greater depravity, especially in light of the fact that he chose to rape a child over her mother, who he tied up but did not sexually assault. However, the fact that he wrapped Margaret in a blanket when she said she was cold may indicate he felt some guilt or remorse about having attacked such a young girl. He used plates stacked on her mother's back as an alarm system, and that's sadistic because it forces her mother to remain absolutely still while she knows he's raping her daughter in the next room. It also indicates he's criminally sophisticated. He's done this before, and it worked. And he's not about to stop. Law enforcement uses every tool available to catch the man who will soon be known as the East Area Rapist. His MO is clear, but discerning a pattern that could predict his next attack is not. In the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit, I was part of a group of experts who profiled hundreds of serial killers. We worked on some of the most notorious cases in U.S. history, including the D.C. sniper murders, the 9/11 terror attacks, the Unabomber, and the Golden State Killer. At the Behavioral Analysis Unit, we'd review the Golden State Killer case every few years, hoping that new information would surface or developments in forensic technology would provide a way for us to finally solve it. In 1977, my mentors at the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit created the first profile of the East Area Rapist. It describes the rapist as a white male, 20 to 25 years old, with above average intelligence, who is introverted, shy, and gives off the impression of being a good boy. It predicts he works a job with minimal contact with the public, was previously in the military, and through his attacks is attempting to prove his masculinity. One sentence stands out. He will continue his assaults until he is either apprehended, moves, or is otherwise incapacitated. But not until later did the FBI realize that before this man became the East Area Rapist, he was the Visalia Ransacker, committing over 100 burglaries, stealing worthless items as souvenirs, and masturbating on women's underwear. Profilers often label this behavior as nuisance or precursor crimes, because although they may not seem serious in nature, they can signal the beginning of an evolution into rape or sexual homicide. If the BAU had known that the East Area Rapist was also the Visalia Ransacker, it would have dovetailed perfectly with their profile, because the Visalia Ransacker did exactly what their behavioral profile would have predicted. He evolved into a violent serial rapist.
This was his 44th attack since his first rape in Sacramento in 1976. The houses he chose for his attacks nearly back up to each other. Police don't know if there's any significance to that.
As the frequency of his attacks increased, he became bolder, and it was feared he would become more violent.
The attacks do continue until 1979, when the East Area Rapist disappears. There are whispers that he might have moved away, gone to jail, or even died. But with no arrests and no new leads, the case goes cold. Detectives are assigned to other cases. As the years go by, most of the physical evidence is lost or destroyed. The case reports are filed away. At this point, the odds that the East Area Rapist case will ever be solved are close to zero. No one is assigned to the case. No one is even looking at it. It's not on any official priority list, and the investigators who worked it are starting to retire. Someone new needs to open that file cabinet, dust off the evidence, and dive in. Fast forward to 1990. A young Paul Holes has a choice to make. Follow the herd into a good corporate job, or step out of that line and take a path less traveled, a dark path that will lead him to the very center of one of the most notorious serial murder cases in history.
So it's now spring of 1990, and I'm finishing up a degree at UC Davis. I studied 4 years to get a degree in biochemistry, and I'm a little bit lost. I don't know what I want to do. I initially pursued that degree thinking I was going to go to medical school, and the reason I wanted to go to medical school was because I had been inspired as a kid by a TV show called Quincy, a forensic pathologist that was solving cases by performing autopsies, looking at physical evidence, and then proceeding to do his own investigations. And I was absolutely enthralled by the storytelling in that show, but even more so by the idea of having an impact on being able to use my intellect to solve cases. But here I am now finishing up my bachelor's degree in biochemistry, and I realized medical school wasn't in the cards. I did not have great grades. I didn't apply myself. I was more interested in playing guitar and girls. I'm in a bit of a scramble. I'm at a job fair, and I'm standing in line for a biotech company. I look over at another booth, and in that booth, there's an old TV stand, the old-style TV. And on that TV screen was a picture of a man laying on a kitchen floor, and he had a pool of blood around his head. And it immediately caught my attention. I was like, what is that? So I get over into that line, and after about 10 minutes, I'm talking to the person manning that booth, Mr. Victor Reeves. And he's from the California Criminalistics Institute. And he starts explaining to me what a criminalist is, a forensic scientist that is using his scientific expertise to examine physical evidence to help solve crimes. And I was sold. I said, that is what I want to do. I ran across an announcement from Contra Costa County Sheriff's Office for a position called forensic toxicologist. It wasn't a criminalist position, but it was in the crime lab. So I drove down to a city in the Bay Area, California, called Martinez. And as I'm driving across the Benicia Bridge, I'm starting to see the oil refineries and all the pipes and everything that's going on in this very industrial county. I thought I was descending into hell. It was such a horrible-looking location. But I was interested in the position, and ultimately was offered the job and hired as a forensic toxicologist. But during that time, the other side of the crime lab had these criminalists, and that's what I wanted to become. And so any chance I could, I went to the other building where these guys were working. Inside this building was this amazing library. And as this fledgling forensic scientist, I became hooked on this library. After 3.5 years, a deputy sheriff criminalist position finally came open. And I was able to apply and get to that position. I'm sent to the police academy and I spend 5 months jumping walls, learning how to shoot, learning about law, and ultimately graduating from the academy and then going back to the crime lab now in the position I wanted as a deputy sheriff criminalist. I was heavily involved in crime scene investigation, being called out to homicide scenes and officer-involved shootings and drug labs. And this library became my home base because in the middle of the night, I often didn't want to drive all the way back up to where I lived, only to turn around and be back at work at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I would sleep on this library floor. It was floor-to-ceiling books on all the walls with a large conference table in the middle. Wood paneling from the 1970s, and I found myself gravitating towards pulling these books on cases and reading them and learning how the investigators worked those cases. The library was central to who I was as a developing criminalist and investigator. In the library was a gray file cabinet that was tucked away in the far left-hand corner, and this file cabinet was dusty. Nobody ever went into it. So as I'm going through looking for another book to pull off the shelf to read, I'm eyeballing that file cabinet. What's in there? So I decide to start opening up the drawers. And I start with the top drawer and I open it up. And it's got old cassette tapes in there from, you know, different lectures that had been recorded. And then I open up the next drawer and it's got some binders in there related to forensic procedures, you know, nothing exciting at all. But the bottom drawer, when I pressed on the clasp and grabbed the handle, I could tell that there was a fair amount of weight inside that drawer. I'm seeing this red EAR that had been handwritten in marker on each of these manila folder tabs. And it caught my eye. I was like, okay, this is different than what I'm seeing in these other drawers. What is this red EAR? I opened up the first manila folder that I pulled out of the drawer, and it was a police report. And it started to detail the activities of a man who had come into a house and had raped a female who had been home alone in her bed in Danville. So, well, that looks interesting, and I put it back, and I pull out the next folder that said EAR on it. And it was another rape attack, another police report, with a man who was wearing a mask, and he had attacked a couple. And in that particular case, he had tossed bindings to the woman and made her tie her husband up, and then had her go face down and lay next to the husband, and then she was bound up by this masked man. And then ultimately he put dishes on the husband's back and took the woman out to the living room and laid her down and sexually assaulted her. I started to recognize, this appears to be a series of cases happening in Contra Costa County back in the 1970s. Then I have a plane ride down to Southern California, and I'm sitting next to my former boss. His name is John Murdoch. He's a very noted forensic scientist. We just happened to coincidentally be riding together on a plane going to a forensic meeting, and we were chatting, and at one point I remembered, hey, he might know about this red EAR file that I'm taking a look at. So I asked him, hey, what is this? What's this red EAR? And I saw his eyes light up, and he goes, oh, that's the East Area Rapist. I was like, well, was it solved? And he goes, no, it was never solved. At this point, I realized I need to do more on this case. I would love to work this East Area Rapist case. Even though it's past statute of limitations with the sexual assaults, you know, we've got this brand new DNA technology we're trying to get up and running, and I'd love to see if I could get DNA and identify who this was. At that point on forward, I took it upon myself to continue working on this case. I never was given any assignments by anybody that I need to do X, Y, and Z on the East Area Rapist series. I made those decisions independently. I sort of went rogue, and that's part of my personality. I don't do bored well.
So you basically dust off these old files. Is anybody following these cases at this point?
No, these things had been tucked in a drawer and forgotten about.
Wow. And what do you think would have happened if you never opened that file cabinet?
It's very possible this case would never have been solved.